Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A challenge to orthodoxy today. Two guests, Lily Geismer and Brent Siebel, in a long single segment talking about professional class liberalism, followed by a brief reprise of a 2019 interview with Gabriel Winant for some further historical context. Maybe it's just the world I live in, but for years now it's been hard to avoid criticism of the professional managerial class, a.k.a. the PMC. The term was coined by Barbara and John Ehrenreich in a pair of essays from 1977. Their original definition, we define the professional managerial class as consisting of salaried mental workers who do not own the means of production and whose major function in the social division of labor may be described broadly as the reproduction of capitalist culture and capitalist class relations. Close quote. That's a broad category and includes lawyers, doctors, architects, middle managers, social workers, nurses, and teachers, and many more. While the Ehrenreich's original analysis was rich and complex, the concept has been banalized into an epithet by the likes of Catherine Liu and Amber Frost, one that signals their contempt for their own stratum in a misplaced allegiance to a partly fantastic working class. To the Frost-Liu tendency, the PMC is the base for what they dismiss as identity politics. Things are more complicated than that, as is what they call identity politics, but that's a separate issue. In recent decades, the PMC has been splitting into a true elite, partners in law and accounting firms, for example, who can really rake it in, and a much less elite, often poorly paid and insecurely employed group like university adjuncts. Even public school teachers operating under a regime of constant budgetary tightness are experiencing downward mobility. Brent Siebel and Lily Geismer have a much more precise view of the PMC and its politics, which they call professional class liberalism, shunning the loaded PMC term. They're just out with a collection of 15 essays, Mastery and Drift, Professional Class Liberal Since the 1960s, published by the University of Chicago Press. Professional class liberalism was the dominant strain of the Clinton and Obama presidencies, a politics that seemed successful at the time, but whose disappointments contributed to the rise of Trump. Brent is an associate professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Lily, who's been on this show a couple of times before, is a professor of history at Claremont McKenna College. Brent Siebel and Lily Geismer. Your title alludes to Walter Lippmann's Drift and Mastery. Why the allusion and why the reversal?
What Lippmann was grappling with in the teens, the book came out in 1914, was this period of profound corporate consolidation and what he defined as social drift. There wasn't a political or democratic response yet that was up to the task of managing these massive corporate and manufacturing forms. And he was a student of the sort of the scientific and professional revolutions that had been happening in universities and culture more broadly. And his idea essentially was that if you could get a set of scientific technical experts to manage society at the level of the political and within firms, you could plan your way rationally out of the sort of social discontents of the era. And part of what we argue is that by the 1970s, this vision had sort of captured both the sort of substance of liberalism in a certain way, but also the growing ranks of those who identified as liberals had become these sort of technical professional experts. And yet, by the time we're writing today, we seem very much to be socially adrift again. And so the question was how do these things relate, both in terms of continuity and discontinuity?
I'll just say one thing. I mean, I think also the other part is this idea of Lippmann watching as kind of, I mean, in some ways it's a response to things like inequality, but also like frustrations with certain versions of mass politics and sort of seeing this as an alternative to those kinds of things. I mean, some of it's like things like the machine politics, but just these more sort of popular visions and sort of wanting the classic kind of progressive search for control. And in some ways we're looking at how the, I would say two parts, a similar kind of what this vision has done to mass politics, but also how far we've taken technocracy, that the pendulum has swung really far, and to just reiterate to Brent's point, has really come to kind of define liberalism in many kinds of ways. And that's one of the things we really were trying to sort of understand in the book, like how this version of the sort of technocratic vision, but also this kind of new professional class has really become the core to what modern liberalism is.
As a personal experience, I was for several years on something called the Cabalist, which was an email discussion list for elite journalists, elite liberal journalists, and pundits. I was invited on as a diversity hire playing the leftist. It didn't really turn out well. But watching them talk among themselves for a few years, I was really impressed by their contempt for and fear of the mob. The mob is driven by irrationality and bigotry. They have a fear of the right that expresses itself not by wanting to fight it, but to avoid provoking it, and a deep belief in expert governance by regulators, judges, technocrats. Your book is an exploration of that cultural formation. Could you talk some about that worldview and where it comes from?
As Lily said, I mean, there's a sort of deep genealogical tie all the way back to the progressive era that Lippmann captures. But I think the other really formative moment is, of course, the 1960s and into the 1970s. And you have these, you know, mass movements of students, the civil rights movement, more radical movements as well. In certain respects, many of the liberals who we write about, the sort of that you know, foundational baby boom generation that defines so much of what the book is about, you know, many of them, I think, shared ostensibly some of the social goals of the civil rights movement, of the anti-war movement against Vietnam, but had both personal proclivities against those sort of mass or more radical approaches to politics, but I think also had a sort of key insight, which was that those movements didn't really affect the shape of the Vietnam War. There was an alternative mode to politics that might be more internalist. And so we talk about Ralph Nader in one of the chapters by Sarah Milov and Will Schiller, the idea that these massive political institutions may be less susceptible to mass political movements. And so what you really need to do is train up, get your degree, and either, you know, sue the bastards or move into the regulatory agencies. There is very much an alternative vision of political change that's at the heart of a lot of these chapters. And I think that's a key part of what we're trying to sort of elevate here is understanding that relationship to democracy and mass movements.
And I should just add in, I mean, I think one of the things that highlight is that in some ways it's both like a class project or class orientation, but also sort of a generational orientation. And so one of the things that we saw is this key kind of transformation that happens is this rise of people who have been trained at elite universities and then have gone on to professional schools in law, business, public policy. And that gives a particular vision of how to manage things. I mean, the way the actual kinds of versions of training and of like a deep commitment to the principles of meritocratic individualism that then become translated into all these other kinds of areas and especially into kinds of forms of governance. The question around journalism is actually super fascinating. There's a chapter in the book by Dylan Gottlieb about the changes that happen in journalism. He's sort of looking and unpacking the idea of liberal elite journalism, but that actually is something that happens. So I think that like what you're describing is an interesting question because it's like actually where they're creating a sort of circular realm of covering these kinds of projects. I don't know if they were on the listserv, but like the New Republic of the 90s to me is like a symbol of that, where they're like amplifying this kind of particular vision in various different forms. I want that like listserv. I wish you'd saved it. I would be so curious what they were talking about.
I do have some things I saved, but I did not save it systematically enough. And you're sworn to secrecy. I'm violating the canons of their ethics by even mentioning it, but I really ended up not liking these people very much. Some of them I do like personally, but as a formation of very bad politics. But another thing that relatedly, looking at that world, both through that list and your work, and also just watching politics over the last several decades, is the utter lack of interest in political organizing that these groups have. For example, the reproductive rights movements, bogged down by a language of choice, drawn from consumer marketing, never really asserting anything in a kind of strong rights way, never really getting very passionate about it, being much more oriented towards litigation and lobbying than actual popular organization. I used to have a neighbor who was the president of New York City Planned Parenthood, and I once asked her why they didn't organize the clients to defend the right to abortion, and she said it's too private a matter. Compare that to the Christian right, which is organizing through churches, lobbying groups, the Republican Party on this issue. This absolute lack of interest in organization. What do you make of that?
One of the chapters that comes immediately to mind when you mention those dynamics is Karen Taney's chapter on disability rights. And one of the things that she's looking at there is the way in which the construction of disability rights in the 1970s and these demands for disability rights did in fact start from some popular movements and organizers. But very quickly, as it becomes a sort of matter of governance, you know, cost-benefit analysis emerges as a way of delineating these rights. And one of the things that I think really comes through in Karen's chapter, as well as some of the other chapters, is the ways in which contemporary liberalism, to your point, is very much about these procedural rights rather than sort of substantive rights, making sure that individuals have their day in court or their ability to litigate, to sue. But there's a profound wariness about that outside movement. And I think that moment of the 1970s is really important here, this moment of fiscal crisis of the state, of the entrenched deindustrialization. And there's a sort of generational concern that the democratic system itself was being overloaded with demands by welfare rights organizers, you know, the Gray Panthers and the Black Panthers and all these groups making demands on the states. And so if you can come up with procedural means by which people can feel as though they're getting something close to a right, maybe you can sort of limit that sort of mass political form of making more substantive demands on the state.
I would say a couple of things. Like, I think the question of sort of like this professionalization of actual movements is a really important one. But I also think, and one of the things we're looking at is like the ways in which this sort of technocratic vision comes into governance, but it also becomes like a political movement too. One of the things that some of the chapters, and this is a sort of combination of Julie Kohler Hausman and then a chapter by Tim Shank, look at is like the ways in which that idea also comes to affect the ways in which Democrats or liberals are thinking about the electorate, and this idea of like what Julie calls like sculpting the electorate, which is an anxiety about post the 1965 Voting Rights Act about mass democracy too. And so you want to have these kind of like very targeted ideas of like who is voting, who is participating, that then actually has cascading political effects on the Democratic Party itself and sort of who is part of its coalition. If you're doing like micro-targeting, which is also about this fear of mass organization, that affects who's participating. And I think I hate to make it hyper-presentist, but like we're very much seeing the consequences of that today, this kind of full-scale approach. I think that's happening in a lot of different fronts, including, I think, organizations like, I don't want to call out Planned Parenthood, but you did, so I will.
Blame me for it, yes.
But who have taken that kind of approach as well. I mean, so that there's like this on all fronts. I will just add, and we can talk about this more, but is another piece of this is this hostility and moving away from organized labor as a model. And so this is like this version of democratic liberal politics is very much agnostic, if not opposed to labor.
Yeah, and I want to just add one point, maybe two quick points there, too. I think the consumerist model of citizenship that you were hinting at there, Doug, I think is a really sort of underappreciated component of how the New Democrats, DLC Democrats, were thinking about policy as fees for services rather than taxes, right? So that sort of model becomes maybe not the dominant metaphor, but it becomes a really prominent one in how liberals are thinking about organizing the delivery of social goods.
Yeah, I was struck by the way, some years ago, the New York City Transit Authority went from referring to subway riders as passengers or riders to customers. The market model has just taken over everything. You say in the intro, the particular ideas about the social and political primacy of the state and practices of governance. In an ongoing but contextually specific search for social rapprochement with capitalism are the foundational characteristics of liberalism. That attempt to be at once a popular party, or that has to have some kind of popular appeal, with a fundamental allegiance to capital. It seems to be the central contradiction of this social formation.
One of the questions is, like, that's one of the core contradictions of modern liberalism itself. And so you can think about that going back, you know, through the New Deal. But you see this manifestation really play out in the 1970s and beyond. We can see this particular constellations playing out time and time again. So that would be how I would sort of think about it. It's like a longstanding question, but then it really does kind of manifest in new ways.
One of the other things that Lily and I have been really committed to is it's not just that it's a rapprochement with capitalism, but it's really core to liberalism, at least going to the New Deal, is the idea that the market and capitalism can be harnessed or worked through for social ends, right? And so that it's not just a partner with the state, but that it actually can become a fundamental means by which the state is going to organize the production of a more equal society or the delivery of certain health insurance, certain social goods like that. And so I do think that if the sort of crass idea about conservatism or free market conservatism is that it's trying to sort of liberate capital, I do think that there is a liberalism as a sort of governing force seeks to work through capital and with capital in really important ways.
Yeah, it's almost like a harnessing of capitalism. I mean, that's something like I, you know, my Left Behind talks about this a lot, but it comes in this book too. And it does come at this sort of technocratic vision that markets, that you sort of see that markets are more efficient and they're more transparent and all of these kinds of language that sort of speaks to some of the way that it aligns with a kind of particular kind of technocratic vision that comes out. And I mean, that goes back to like the sort of idea of like applying a cost benefit analysis, which is also about a kind of embrace of market thinking too. So it's both about this idea of like, we can use capitalism to do good, but if we like apply these market ideas to the function of government, that will make government more efficient and effective as well.
Okay, I want to talk about several of the chapter's specific issues in turn here, starting with philanthropy. Philanthropy is very central to this kind of liberalism. It's structurally condescending, based on the social preferences of the liberal rich, structurally anti-democratic in a lot of ways, that the program officers decide what should be done and not the public. It's strange. It occupies some kind of liminal zone between the state and the private, given all the legal indulgence it enjoys. So, yeah, talk about this role of philanthropy in shaping this consciousness and this political formation.
It is this fusion of this idea of using capitalism to do good. And so you're doing this redefinition. And I think one of the things that's fascinating is the way that the state and Lila Berman's wonderful chapter talks about this and is part of her larger book, but all the ways in which the state is sort of allowed for it in various different capacities. But I think the other part and it, that's important, and this is another theme that runs through the work, is there's so much association with like the sort of liberalism as big government, but there's also within it is this, these sort of themes of a certain kind of state skepticism and working like outside of the state. And so you see through philanthropy an idea of like you like working through in some ways the private sector to deliver on certain kinds of social goods. And so there's a long history of using philanthropy for that. And as you said, I mean, what this does increasingly is really does sort of build up the nonprofit sector in various different ways, but it also allows for a lack of democratic accountability, which is fascinating in terms of the liberal ideas of like efficiency and transparency, because it's like actually completely like it's a completely unaccountable system.
Yeah, I was struck the bit in that chapter about the USAID, which is very much in the news these days. And it was structurally designed to carry out its programs through a private sector and voluntary agencies. And then you know, that giving over of a lot of power and initiative to NGOs got adopted by the World Bank and in the Clinton era became very much a substitute for state activity and thought to be more efficient, more market-driven, more flexible. People don't really appreciate the value that so many liberals apply to NGOs and private activity as opposed to supposedly publicly accountable bodies.
And not just values, I mean, pioneered it. I mean, and that's really what the chapter you're mentioning by Stephen Massacara is interested in, is the ways in which this New Deal generation sort of goes out into the world and brings these public-private partnership models of projecting American power abroad. One of the things that I think when we're thinking about sort of change over time here that's really important to capture, both in the philanthropy chapter that Lila Corwin Berman wrote and Stephen Massacara's, is there's an idea that the philanthropists or consultants are going to do experimental or they're going to try out ideas that might ultimately be brought under the public domain. You think about the war on poverty, which was very much pioneered by the Ford Foundation in the early 1960s and even late 1950s. And as you said, Doug, I mean, one of the things that starts to happen here is that through the sort of emergence of this philanthropy industrial complex, the contractor industrial complex, they become viewed as ostensibly more efficient or less bureaucratically weighty alternatives to creating an agency that's going to have congressional appropriations annually that have to be haggled over. And so instead, we can just outsource this stuff and call it a day, call it a program.
When I wrote my Hillary Clinton book, which is not fan mail by any means, I was struck by the contrast between the Clinton Foundation. The book does mention the Clinton Foundation is really exemplary in this area. Their efforts to relieve AIDS in Africa with PEPFAR, George Bush's state-driven program, and the NGO, the Clinton Foundation's efforts were really mild and symbolic, and they're trying to, like, you know, get drug companies to do the right thing for a little PR. Whereas the Bush program mobilized a large amount of public money and has done remarkable things, now being undone by the Trump administration, but they did remarkable things to control AIDS in Africa. The scorn for the public sector is really not an accurate judge of how effective it can be.
That's absolutely right. And I think you see that state skepticism lurking in a whole range of our chapters. And I think one of the things that we try to point to in the introduction is that there's a wariness that is sort of genealogically liberal about the construction of large state power. And this is something I've written about extensively in some of my work, you know, that it's there in the New Deal, that you want to do things as locally as possible. You want to structure a market for housing. Like that's what redlining was, right? We want to ensure the market, not deliver housing directly. And so to say that neoliberalism is a sharp break with the mid-century and earlier forms of liberalism would be to miss the ways in which it's in some ways an amplification or acceleration of certain of those anti-statist tendencies.
And then fast forward to the 60s, they were doing the same thing with urban development.
Absolutely.
I think this, the question of the through line, and then you can see in the Clinton era as this kind of version of this kind of politics in all kinds of ways, you see a lot of continuity in building up this kind of hostility to the state and like what the state can do, even as they're trying to like make it more technocratic in various different kinds of ways. They weren't envisioning Doge, but like that this is actually like a continuation of Doge's building on a longstanding tradition of state skepticism that has been bred by liberals as much as conservatives.
Doge's Clintonism on psychedelics, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Like it was a quaint version of Al Gore standing out, you know, with the red light, like with all the things he was like taking out, and they were
reinventing government. Yeah,
that's exactly. Yeah, for the Reinvent Government project, which was like at a much smaller scale, but that was actually like a huge part of what they ran on, and was like a big part of the first, you know, what they were doing in the first term, and you know, the visions of like the era is big government is over. All of that does like lay the foundations for a lot of what we're seeing right now.
One thing I want to flag there, though, that I think is a really important context for the ways that, as we're saying, the sort of like genealogical features of liberalism's emphasis on efficiency or limiting government is the political economic context in which these ideas are being sort of redeployed, right? And so in the New Deal, you've got a strong focus on the industrial sector, on partnering with the big corporate form of the era, which were much more sort of nationally and locally rooted. And by the time you get to the 1990s and you've got Clinton, you know, as David Stein's chapter in the book emphasizes, there's a real concern for Wall Street. There's an overriding concern for bond markets, interest rates, and that those become the sort of master sectors in terms of liberals' ideas about what the economy is capable of and who they want to work through and for. And so I wouldn't say that anything that Musk is doing is particularly liberal at the moment, but I think, you know, the way in which that's being articulated through a sort of Silicon Valley ethos is really significant as well, and marks a key difference with some of those earlier periods.
That's the voice of Brent Siebel. I'm talking to him and Lily Geismer about the book they edited, Mastery and Drift, published by the University of Chicago Press. Now here's Lily.
I mean, I hope this is the last time we talk about Elon Musk, but I was going to say that I think that
may not be able to avoid it, but
yeah, we'll try. It should be like a new drinking game. Another chapter actually that I've been thinking a lot about in the last month is actually the one by Mark Adenoff about the computerization of welfare and this idea of using the welfare system and this idea of, I mean, both it's about this kind of anti-welfare vision of trying to find people who are cheating the system, but also the importance of computerization and what that did to the state, which I think the chapter does really powerfully. And I was thinking of this with Musk saying, like, you control the computers, you control everything. But that actually also comes from some of this kind of like these liberal ideas, even though he sees himself very much as like anti-liberal in so many ways.
And just to put a fine point on that, I think just to give the listeners a little bit of a taste of what Mark Adenoff is up to in that chapter, I mean, what he's showing is that the increased technological capacity, the interoperability of welfare systems across state lines, enables state welfare administrators to not just deliver welfare payments through computerization, which, you know, might limit the soft-hearted local welfare administrator from giving too many benefits or admitting somebody onto the rolls inappropriately, but it also enables them to garnish the wages of the quote-unquote deadbeat dads who might not even live in the state anymore. And so it actually changes substantively the idea of welfare as an entitlement for someone to something that might, to go back to that cost-benefit analysis, that might be offset by, you know, extracting resources from someone else. And so that technological development actually plays a fundamental role in re-articulating or changing what we thought of as a sort of substantive right.
Okay, we'll talk some about Naderism. And a fun and little-known fact about Nader, his first published article was in the libertarian journal The Freeman, arguing against public housing for all the standard conservative reasons. So I always thought that Nader had a deeply conservative streak, so I always enjoy reading criticisms of his politics. As the authors Milov and Schiller say, a close examination of his approach to activism reveals to be anything but inclusive or based on mass participation. He was all for initiatory activism, with a small number of highly educated professional elites in charge. Many of them very well off, because he was paying them virtually nothing at all, so they needed mommy and daddy's money. How does Ralph Nader, who I think to most people is a good guy, how does he fit into this story?
there's a number of ways, like, I think that the kind of version of Naderism is so sort of central to the kind of transformations of liberalism that are going on. It's often sort of forgotten in kind of political history. And I think that both Myloff and Schiller, and then there's also a book by Paul Sabin, sorry, about Ralph Nader that came out a couple of years ago. For our purposes, I mean, is his particular vision of the state and this idea of trying to root out various different forms of corruption, thinking about regulatory capture. But I think also about who the actual interns were is really important, and that this inculcation of a particular worldview that becomes like hugely influential going forward. And so the very story you told about the kind of people who are working for Ralph Nader is actually like ethnographically who we're describing in a lot of the parts, other parts of the book.
Out of Ivy League law schools and with some inheritance.
I mean, I think this idea that too, that you could have this small group of people that comes out of it. And I think that there's an interesting thing of like, these are people who are slightly younger than the quintessential like anti-war protesters. But like, this was the thing to do if you were like ambitious, but also committed, like you believed in this cause. I mean, one of the things about Nader is like, you believe that you're doing good. And that was really inspiring to this whole generation of elite law students.
The other piece of this that I think is really important that we shouldn't overlook is the way in which, you know, there may be sort of a libertarian strand in Nader. I totally buy that. But I also think that, you know, on some level, he shares a new left critique of corporate liberalism and the ways in which the large corporations in the mid-century years, from the automakers to the military contractors, had captured the regulatory state and the congressional appropriations in really important ways. This sort of litigious insider way of approaching it, I think, did strike people as potentially more effective than the sort of outside game, which did bring us pluralism, did bring us these big unions, which for many of the new left and many of the students of this generation were just as complicit in the war and were just as sclerotic and hyper-bureaucratized as the state and as these corporations had become. And so the political culture was in such flux in the 60s and early 70s that I think it's really important to capture that.
It's funny you mentioned unions, because I recall I was writing an article on deregulation, a history of deregulation, many, many years ago, and I read some of the Nader's Raiders books, and I was struck by how anti-union they were. I think particularly the trucking deregulation one was all about how the unions are part of the whole monopolistic structure, and it made me uncomfortable as a union supporter to read that. But I guess that does fit into the sensibility. And then the later New Democrats would be very distant from or even hostile to unions.
There's a whole history to be written, I think, about, you know, the New Directions movement in labor in the 70s and 80s. That, you know, I think Nelson Lichtenstein and Judith Stein touch on, and is there in McAlevey's writing, of course. But I think, you know, a big part of the labor politics of the 1970s was sort of insurgent struggles for democracy in the unions. And that is not something that I think has been totally aired among scholars and the left as well.
But I do think there's the question, too, of like the issue of the continuities of someone like Nader to some aspects of the kind of who become the New Democrats. And there is like a kind of lineage of tracking many of the people who like worked for Nader to then go into the Clinton administration or to be admiring a certain aspect of that politics. So it's not as much of a break as it might seem. And I do think a lot of it does have to do with this kind of hostility to a certain kind of like what, I mean, that unions are big, that they're a drag on certain kinds of efficiency. So it's not just about like I think there's a political vision, like in terms of like actual sort of electoral politics, but it's also about what unions stand for in terms of like a kind of political economy too, that you see the roots of in this kind of early 70s moment.
One of the most outspoken critics of the bailout of Chrysler in the early 80s was none other than Robert Reich.
No, Reich is all over the place politically. It's really hard to track him. Something that runs throughout all this is the centrality of smarts. Obama loved smarts. He opposed the invasion of Iraq because it was a dumb war. He doesn't oppose all wars, just dumb wars. But yeah, what about this valorization of smarts that's so important to these characters?
Brent counted like how many times he used it.
I did not do that. It was in a David Brooks column, speaking of smarts. Yeah, he used it over 900 times in office to describe his politics as smart, smart governance, smart policies, things like that. In his chapter, Dylan Gottlieb gets into this. You know, there's the whole sort of proto-Matt Iglesias style of journalist that's emerging in the 1990s, who are not only sort of fashioning themselves as policy experts within the bounds of what seems politically or fiscally possible. You know, they'll constantly sort of remind us about the hard choices that are going to have to be made. But they're the ones who can actually understand these convoluted Rube Goldberg-like policy structures that are being created. And to give them a degree of credit here, you know, when you're working in a hyper-polarized congressional setting where you're not likely to get, you know, massive buy-in for big appropriations, you know, figuring out these nudges, as Cass Sunstein might call them, or other ways of delivering programs through the market do have a certain sort of ingeniousness to them, but what they are not is visible, moral, or clear forms of politics.
Yeah, and you can sell them as smart because, like, you can say something that's hyper technical and hyper smart is like that's a smart version of it. So that's some of what we see happening. And so, in some ways, I mean, what we came to is that, like, Obama is so much the kind of apotheosis of this vision. And so this idea of him using the term smart governance as much as he did really does symbolize this particular kind of approach. And Nicole Hemmer has a chapter in the book about the kind of Obama years, which highlight those kinds of things as kind of this culmination of a lot of this kind of thinking. But I think to Brent's point, absolutely, like, this idea of, like, this is the way it sort of becomes packaged and sold, which is in some ways also leads to a certain degree of alienation and frustration that we start to also see play out against this kind of approach.
Almost by definition. I mean, the idea of the smart, savvy politico is somebody who is fundamentally on the inside and knows how the inside works. And all of you rubes on the outside, you know, just trust us that we're going to deliver the right outcome for you eventually.
There was quite an evolution of the structure of feeling from Clinton to Obama. Clinton was very much, you know, effusive, libidinal, really great at person-to-person politics. Obama was all about being detached and cerebral and cool, and he was not very good at person-to-person politics. So I don't know. It's just it's not a formula for political popularity.
I think it's worth mentioning Daniel Wiggins' chapter as well, which speaks to this sort of deep, what she calls state skepticism among African-American liberals, you know, dating back to the Reconstruction era and after. And I think part of what she's tapping into there, we mentioned, you know, the welfare rights movement and the explosion of demands on the state in the 1970s, is there's, I think, what part of what Obama internalized was this idea that there was an assumption among the pundit class, among conservatives, certainly, that the arrival of Obama necessarily means that we're going to get a massive new welfare state. And part of, I have to believe on some level that that sort of bloodless affect that you mentioned is in part a bit of political theater there to sort of try to signal that, no, I'm not Jesse Jackson. I'm not calling for reindustrialization. And in fact, I am the insider's insiders here, and you need not worry about me overreaching in that way.
I'm reasonable. Like, I mean, there's such a sort of idea of, like, of being reasonable, which is another kind of way of thinking about, like, a synonym for smart. Both of them are so, you know, have so many sort of different sides to them. But there is that kind of hyper, like, that there's the Clinton campaigner, but there's also that hyper technical part of Clinton, too. I mean, there's such a wonkiness to his.
Oh, I remember him announcing the Human Genome Project. He was just really into that.
You can see that very much playing out. I mean, there's sort of multiple sides. And I will say, like, one thing is, like, in many ways, this project is actually like a generational one, and our coming of age politically in the eras of Clinton and Obama, that this is the version of liberalism that we know and have tried to kind of, and this is true of all of our writers who are sort of come of the same kind of cohort of, like, trying to understand both its dominance, but also its sort of fundamental limitations. It's in some ways like watching these two administrations play out that have, like, that sort of motivated this book in a lot of ways.
One other point I want to add there about Obama that I think is worth pointing out. He's in some ways the ideal Democratic candidate in the age of the political consultant that Julie Kohler Houseman and Tim Shank write about. The politics of evasion, the Kmark and Galston memo advising the New Democrats of the late 1980s to not overtly appeal for Black voters' support is sort of famous at this point. But there's a way in which I think Obama sort of internalized that concern that if we go too hard for mobilizing African American voters explicitly, we're going to push white people out of the coalition. And so there's a way in which Obama, by not appealing directly to African-American voters, but nevertheless galvanizing their support, became sort of the perfect candidate for that kind of deracinated vision of political mobilization. And then in his second term, when he dared to point out that some of these kids that cops are killing look like his own, you know, that was it. I mean, that was all he had to say to sort of prove, you know, on some level, the pollsters correct. And so that, again, speaks to his studied and really considered timidity around some of these issues.
Well, he also went out of his way to insult black people a lot of the time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So in the 70s, Irving Kristol and the neocons mount a critique of the new class, intellectual elite that dominated society, according to them. This is a line that's persisted on the right today. Many of these screeds were published by elite outlets and funded by right-wing foundations, but let's leave that aside. But in this move, like, shareholders and CEOs recede from interest and are replaced by Ivy League elitists. Now, there's some truth to this, but a rather selective one. So could you sort out the truth and falsehood of this whole neocon new class analysis?
It's an interesting question, too, because it's like, the other sort of inspiration for this came from, like, the ways in which, like, the PMC turn, actually, there's a long-standing critique of that from the right, but you start to also see it come emerge from the left at various different moments, became, like, reconstituted following the 2016 election of that terminology. And so in some ways, part of what we are trying to do, actually, is to sort of think through why this has caused so much ire. And I think you're right. I mean, in some ways, it's a question of, like, is this the right place to be directing a lot of critique and blame? Like, as you're not thinking about sort of targeting it towards other kinds of elite actors, and this becomes a kind of easy target. But I think we did want to kind of think about what this vision has brought, and how this particular, like, what it means to have this particular group of people so hold the kind of particular place over the left side of the political spectrum for so long. And one of the things it's done, actually, too, is to, like, crowd out the actual left in various different ways that it kind of, like, we've seen that happen, too. And that goes back to the kind of story of how labor movements don't hold the place that they do in the Democratic constellation after the 1970s onward.
When we're thinking about the conservative versus the left critique of the PMC, I mean, I think one of the things that I think is really important to note is on some level, I actually think the conservative critique is more on the money. What they're pointing out is that these managerial elites are abrogating capital's property rights in a certain sort of fundamental way to, you know, the direction of and the use of their capital, the enjoyment of their capital. And that the left critique of the PMC, you know, I think the Ehrenreichs get this correctly, but I think when we think about this, the way that it becomes a sort of affective or cultural critique of the PMC misses their involvement in capitalism itself. And I think one of the things that we try to point to in the introduction is that you can't disassociate this class formation, these ideas about the law, about economics, from the sort of broader capitalist structures within which they're operating. And so part of what we're trying to do is to locate philanthropy, to locate the media, to locate public interest law shops in this sort of broader class formation that is arising at a particular moment in capitalist development as well.
But I think one of the things I think to build on it, too, is, like, we also wanted to take seriously their self-conception and this faith. I mean, this goes to circle back, but about this vision of harnessing capitalism to do good and this faith in, like, what they're doing is fundamentally good. And that is so baked into so many aspects of, like, what we call them professional class liberals, of their self-conception and vision is.
One of the things the Ehrenreichs, I think, got really right when they named the PMC in those first two essays was that they talked about how this emergent class believed that their interests were identical to the interests of society at large. And that's a really dangerous thing. That's a really dangerous thing politically, to not see other classes, social experiences out there in the world.
That PMC label can be very misleading in that it includes elite lawyers who really are servants of capital, but also teachers and nurses with credentials who are more and more of the working class of today. So I don't know. That label can cause a lot of problems.
I tend to, like, pick topics to study of, like, terms that are really, like, imprecise, like the same thing of, like, suburbs or things that are, like, neoliberal. I mean, there's all of these terms. I think, actually, like, there's a lot of ways about professional class, because that does speak to, like, a much, like, you can put a lot of different people in there. And I think one of the things that happens is that, like, the ways in which actually you're creating a broad category of people whose interests are not always aligned, so there's actually a lot of class slippage within that. it's different to be like a partner at a law firm to like a contingent faculty member teaching, you know, five classes for $5,000 each. So I think in some ways the term about being sort of educated captures both of those groups, but it gets a very different kind of class-based experience. We use this more precise term of professional class liberal because I think the PMC can have some of those pitfalls.
Okay, we're running low on time, so let's bring this towards a conclusion. You don't have a grand conclusion to this. You didn't write a concluding chapter on somewhat what this all means. You did a very nice introduction, but not a what this all means kind of consideration towards the end. And also, this is written before the dawn of Trump, too. And we're seeing now James Carville telling the Dems to roll over and play dead, and Hakeem Jeffries counseling them to lie low and wait for the midterms. They have neither ideas nor energy, no capability to rise to the severity of the challenge that the Trump-Musk, I'm sorry, I bring his name up again, the Trump-Musk regime presents. It looks almost like Trump has really busted up this formation. So what is going to happen to it? It seems really not up to the challenges of the present.
One thing I will say, I mean, I think there's at least two things to point to. I think one, I wouldn't give Trump all the agency in busting up this formation. I think there are a whole series of structural crises around technology, climate, massive inequality that we would be facing whether Trump was in the White House or not. And one of the things that's just clear is that this inside game is simply not up to the task of organizing the kinds of political formations that are going to be essential to dealing with these crises. And so I think one thing that we see is that this hyper-particularistic way of thinking about organizing a coalition, this timidity, and this unwillingness to trust the masses and to cultivate, you know, mass publics is going to be the thing that leads to massive change among the left liberal coalition. It's no coincidence that the people who are out there doing rallies right now are Bernie Sanders and AOC, right? It's not anybody else.
You know, we didn't write a conclusion, but we did write a piece for Jacobin this fall about Bidenism and the ways in which, like, the kind of Bidenism, but I think you can see it very much played out actually in some of the, like, sort of reactions to Bidenism amongst the Harris campaign. We didn't get into this, and maybe it was too like traumatic for everyone to talk about, but the Harris campaign was a kind of represented these instincts in so many ways, and so
and very badly.
Very bad. Like, it's almost like the worst possible version of all of this. So I do think that the question that Brendan's bringing up of like the responses to that of being really important. And I think the other side of this is like also a recognition. So both in terms of like the actual ways of doing politics that have come up and the limitations to that, but also the kind of some of the ways of thinking about governance and this like small hyper technical versions of governance, which I do think have led to a suspicion, if not hostility, to the state. Also need to be sort of so fundamentally rethought, and that's another place for this to happen. So in some ways, like watching what is happening by Trump and Musk has actually opened up a possibility for thinking of alternative visions of like what governance could be, and that's one thing that gives me hope. The book shows us in all these different chapters, but this was a deliberate process of remaking liberalism and its transformation, and like that is possible. So our hope is like that can happen again.
Those were Lily Geismer and Brent Siebel, editors of Mastery and Drift from the University of Chicago Press. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of the first movement of the string quartet number 4 by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by the Sorrel Quartet. I've got a little time left over, so I thought I'd fill it with a bit from a 2019 interview on the PMC with Gabriel Winant, an associate professor of history at the University of Chicago and a contributor to the Siebel Geismer collection. Apologies for the poor audio quality. the term professional managerial class, the PMC, is all over the place. What about the history of this idea? Where did it come from?
Well, the idea of the PMC has very old kind of precursors going back into the early 20th century in debates in Europe, in particular in Germany, and then in the kind of Trotskyist world trying to make sense of what had happened to the Russian Revolution and how it became bureaucratized. But in this country, it's formulated in the form in which we know it today in the 1970s. And the actual phrase comes from Barbara and John Ehrenreich in a pair of essays that they wrote in the late 1970s in the journal Radical America. And they wrote those essays to try to diagnose what had gone wrong with the new left and to try to provide a kind of material analysis of that and then chart a path forward.
What was this formation?
You know, in the 19th century, there had been what was often called the old middle class, which is like shopkeepers, craftsmen, and that had been destroyed by capitalism, as Marx predicted. But then 20th century society didn't polarize into two classes. Instead, what they called monopoly capitalism, that is the capitalism organized into large corporations run by managers as opposed to owners, monopoly capitalism created and depended upon this new stratum, the PMC, to carry out a series of functions, most fundamentally to control the working class and to supervise production and accumulation and to reproduce social relations writ large.
What kind of occupations are we talking about here?
Teachers, social workers, scientists, engineers, managers, nurses, doctors, academics, and so on. Credentialed professionals. And the idea was that these people would get a handle on the unruly qualities of the proletariat, keep it in line, and remold it as it was needed, and in doing so would reproduce capitalist society over time. What the Ehrenreichs then said was this class, in some ways, actually had an oppositional consciousness. Going all the way back to the turn of the 20th century, many members of this class saw themselves as the ones who actually knew how things worked, saw the owners of capital as kind of rentiers, basically, so could conceive of a kind of technocratic socialism based on their own social position. That's basically the best way of understanding what the progressive movement of the early 20th century was an effort to kind of rationalize society coming from the kind of new emergent new professional experts to try to put labor and capital relations on a more stable basis, to update democracy, and probably eventually gradually to transition into socialism.
That's not the Teddy Roosevelt brand, though.
No, but people who would have been enthusiastic about Teddy Roosevelt, you know, someone like Jane Addams, for example.
Yeah, but now Jane Addams also was trying to calm the working class, tranquilize it, and to show to the working class that maybe the rich folks weren't so bad after all.
Certainly. And at the same time, you know, she was, of course, genuinely interested in improving working conditions and living conditions for working class people and, you know, did have a kind of, I think, long-term, a lot of these types of characters had a long-term vision of a more humane, less kind of market-ruled society. The Ehrenreichs look at this and they say, right, this is a kind of precedent from which we can understand that the PMC is capable of generating an oppositional ideology, but it's an oppositional ideology which still carries within it a belief in the rule of professionals over the proletariat.
But then they also felt annoyed by the demands of profit-making, that it was interfering with their rationalization of the process of production and distribution.
Right. And that's in part where the kind of oppositional quality, kind of the potential for radicalism comes from, right? I want to do my science, or, you know, I have a vision of how the city should be laid out. And on that basis, I develop a criticism of capitalism overall, right? But it's not necessarily one that exactly imagines the emancipation or rule of the working class. And so everybody looks back on this and they say, this is a sort of prequel to the same thing that's happened in the 1960s. That what the new left was a movement of the young professional managerial class as it's expanded through the growth of the universities and the military industrial complex. Right? The mass university has generated this mass student movement whose fundamental basis is this kind of opposition. And for that reason, the new left has been unable to bridge the gap with the working class and to form the kind of alliance that actually could fundamentally transform society.
But as the 60s progressed, we went from, you know, the Port Huron Statement to much more radical activism on campuses, but then the black movement went from civil rights to real black power disruptive stuff. That also radicalized some portion of that that student new left.
Absolutely. By the end of the 60s, many of them are becoming Marxists or developing real relationships with Marxism in one way or another. But then there's this whole debate that begins in the late 60s about who are we? What is our place in society? What is, in fact, the class nature of our society? In the moment, there's a kind of a two-way split. On one hand are formations like PL, kind of quasi-Maoist formations, which basically say only the traditional working class is capable of revolution. Given that, we, the white student left, need to industrialize ourselves, go take jobs in mines and mills and factories, and try to kind of spread whatever version of Marxism. There's Trotskyists who do have this going on too, obviously. Then, on the other hand, the Revolutionary Youth Program, which takes a much broader kind of view of what class division in the late 60s looks like, basically argues that students of the working class already, along with the Panthers and all kinds of different formations, just broadly already are a working class movement.
The Ehrenreichs emphasize that the relationship between the PMC and the working class is objectively one of conflict.
Yes. What the Ehrenreichs say is that there is a conflict between the PMC and the working class that is fundamental to the nature of the PMC. It's why it exists, right? It's to govern the working class on behalf of the ruling class, which is the actual owners of capital. This conflict manifests in all kinds of ways in the fabric of daily life, right? Social workers are contemptuous of and disrespectful to their clients. Teachers discipline their students, on and on like this. Managers, obviously, discipline workers.
The middle manager may not be high up the social scale, but that's the person that the guy on the line experiences most directly.
Right.
Finally, we don't want to throw out the professional ideal completely, right? You say in your piece, for all the cynicism and compromises that professional pretensions engender, professional labor does carry utopian seed. What do you mean by that?
Professionals often have deep identification with positive qualities of their work. Something has attracted them to this work is meaningful beyond the money that they get paid for and the status that accrues to them. Now, that's true for all kinds of non-professional work, too. But it takes a distinctive form for professionals. That is something that the left can draw on to mobilize people for emancipatory as opposed to repressive causes. I think about something like Science for the People, for example, which was an organization established in the 70s, revitalized recently, which, you know, just in Boston where I live, there are folks in Science for the People who are doing work around lead remediation and trying to actually make the case that the state needs to do a better job and private real estate developers need to kind of pay more, basically, around like livable living conditions, residential conditions for working class people. Now, that draws on the ideology of being, in some way, on the professional ethic of being a scientist, right? When scientists actually present themselves as experts who can offer a kind of useful testimony around this and so on. And that, I think, is something that we can embrace, and in embracing it, actually speed the process of realigning elements of the PMC with the working class and decomposing the overall authority of the PMC.
That was the historian Gabriel Winant, one of the contributors to Mastery and Drift, from a 2019 interview on this show. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more Shostakovich, this from the String Quartet No. 6, First Movement, performed again by Sorrel. Till next week, bye.